Welcome to Worldly, Vox's weekly guide to the most important stories in the world, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. There are weeks where photos are just stunning. And in this past week, the photos in Puerto Rico of hospitals flooded, of streets clogged, of people literally begging for help because it's 105 degrees and they're out of water, those are the ones we've been seeing. But there are times where the numbers also matter. And I just want to read a couple of them. 3.4 million. That's the number of Puerto Ricans who are all American citizens. 1,560, which is the miles from where we are recording this to Puerto Rico, which is not very far. Unknown, which is how many have died or how much it'll cost to rebuild all of this. And perhaps the most jarring of all, 46, which are the percentage of Americans who don't know that people born in Puerto Rico are themselves American citizens.
We're not worth anything to them. It's the same in Congress in the U.S. They implement laws that are detrimental to us. And as soon as there's an emergency out here, they forget about the fact that we are a U.S. territory.
All of which raises two very big questions. One, how did we get here? How do we get to a place where the United States has colonies? And how does that impact how we rebuild after this kind of catastrophe? So here to talk this through, we have Jen, we have Zach.
So it is fair to call Puerto Rico a colony of the United States right now. To understand why, you need to go back at least to 1898, which is the Spanish-American War, when the U.S. took control of Puerto Rico. After that, the United States actually literally administered it like a colony with a colonial authority set up through Washington. It was a time when imperialism was widely accepted among Western countries, and the U.S. wanted to get in on the game. This changed in 1952 when Puerto Rico got its own constitution and has a local government. However, it's still subordinate to the United States in a lot of different ways. It's a U.S. territory, but at the same time, it doesn't maintain the same rights. Its citizens don't get to vote for president. They don't have representation in Congress. And it also has a lot of its policies run centrally through Washington. They don't have autonomy over a lot of economic policy. So as a result, you have this weird in-between situation where Puerto Rico hasn't decided to try to make a bid for statehood, and honestly, my guess is that would fail, while simultaneously isn't an independent country, but it's also not part of the United States. So it is a kind of modern colony, even though we don't use that term anymore.
And I think it's important to talk through also what that means specifically in terms of like disaster relief. When we're looking at, you know, the aftermath of Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria, both of which swept through the Caribbean, hit other islands that are also U.S. territories, including the U.S. Virgin Islands. When you look at like the response, right, there's been a lot of criticism about the way the Trump administration handled the response, particularly to the U.S. Virgin Islands and to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And, you know, it was this kind of refrain that, you know, we've been forgotten, like we heard on that clip. We've been forgotten. You know, they don't care about us. They don't know that we're American citizens. And Trump's, you know, argument was, well, you know, the logistics are hard. It's surrounded by a big ocean, big water, I think was the quote. And he's right. It is a logistical challenge. It's harder to get aid to, you know, an island that's remote as opposed to getting to Texas or Florida. But it also has to do with the fact, Zach, that you raised, that they don't have a voting representative in Congress. They have a non-voting representative in the House. But, you know, the policies that Congress passes, the laws that Congress passes, apply to Puerto Rico. And they also, since Puerto Rico had a financial crisis, Congress essentially took over running entire parts of the Puerto Rican economy. So they have a lot more control even than they used to. So you have these people who are Americans who they don't have to have a passport to travel, you know, to the mainland United States. They're protected by the Constitution, the same Bill of Rights as everyone else. Yet they don't really have a say in the policies that affect them. And they also don't have, like Zach, you said, they don't get to vote for president. They don't have electoral college votes. They do vote in presidential primaries, oddly, but they don't have, you know, for the general election, which means politicians in Washington and particularly, you know, maybe the president don't have a political incentive to pay attention to them. They don't have a loud voice in Congress. They don't have someone who can stand up and, you know, block things and vote for things that affect them, which means that when it comes to disaster relief, they tend to get kind of shoved back to the back burner, especially when you have rival crises, you know, happening in Texas and Florida that are much more present, that are big electoral vote states.
It's also worth mentioning that it's not just Puerto Rico. When we're talking about colonies, there's also Guam, which has a kind of similar setup. There's also the U.S. Virgin Islands, whose population Both have, to a degree, congressional delegates who don't vote, who do not vote for president, but who also don't pay federal income tax. So unlike residents like us of Washington, whose electoral vote is irrelevant, at least they don't have to pay taxes. But Puerto Rico is kind of unique, one, because it's so big in terms of population, two, because it's so close, and three, because it is impoverished. I mean, the level of just deprivation before this, of the stuff Trump said, it is true that Puerto Rico's infrastructure has been abysmal. Its power grid has been abysmal. The levels of poverty, unemployment are super high. And I think even that is surprising to us as Americans. Like, we don't think of other Americans living necessarily in that sort of profound poverty, and yet we have them, and they do.
Right. And this one is also, in a large respect, Washington's fault. So Puerto Rico's economy in the post-1952 era ended up being built around a series of tax subsidies that the United States government gave it that allowed businesses to set up in Puerto Rico with relatively low cost. Then in 1996, Congress decided that it didn't really like that anymore. And so it set a 10-year expiration date on these tax breaks. So in 2006, they expired. Then all of the local businesses fled. A lot of them fled to the Cayman Islands and didn't end up paying the federal taxes that they were supposed to pay to begin with on top of this. So this devastated the Puerto Rican economy because, you know, it had a large pharmaceutical industry, for example, and that was devastated by the expiration of the federal tax breaks. And then on top of that, you had 2 years later, the global financial crisis. And that totally screwed over Puerto Rico as a country, not through any choices that it made on its own, but because Washington was setting the foundations of its economy. This is not a sovereign territory that enjoys U.S. protections. It is much closer to a colony, as uncomfortable as that is for Americans to admit.
Right. And the two things are related. Like, that's not disconnected, that the fact that their economy was devastated and the fact that they have been hit so hard by this hurricane.
Yeah.
Obviously, the hurricane itself is a natural disaster. That's not Washington's fault. But academic studies have shown that countries who already have poor economic growth, who have high levels of poverty, tend to be harder hit by natural disasters because they, first of all, don't have the kind of robust infrastructure that's needed, buildings that are more resilient to hurricane conditions, things like that. But they also don't have the budget to put into disaster preparations. So putting in the kind of organizational bureaucratic structures that you need to plan for a massive disaster like this. And if you compare Puerto Rico to Cuba, Cuba is a sovereign country. It's in the same general region, so it's also consistently affected by hurricanes and things like that. But it's made disaster preparation a main focal point of its government. So they devote billions of dollars to preparing for disasters like this, unlike Puerto Rico, which, because it doesn't really even have control over its own budget, its own economy, can't do that unless Washington says it's okay. And the point is that it's not able to make choices for itself, like you said, Zach.
The question of what choices it can make for itself is fascinating, as is the question of what happens when they don't make those choices and then a disaster ensues. The percentage we were talking about at the outset of basically nearly half of Americans who don't know Puerto Ricans are Americans, the same poll that found that found another interesting number, which is 80% of Americans who know that Puerto Ricans are American citizens support financial aid to Puerto Rico. But 40% who don't know that they are citizens, only that 40% supports it. So there's like a literal concrete impact. If Americans don't know Puerto Ricans are Americans, they don't want to help. And when you have a crisis like this, where it is generational to rebuild, we're not talking months, we're not talking years. I was speaking yesterday to someone who's made about 9 flights so far in and out. And he told me one thing that stuck with me as an image. He visited a hospital 20 minutes by car outside San Juan, which has no electricity, no medicine, no basic supplies, including Band-Aids. It has no power, no water, no internet access. And while he was there, the mayor of this town said, "This is what's left of our hospital." And what he was thinking, this person I spoke to, was, "That's not a hospital. That's just a dark building that has sick people inside of it." And that's what Puerto Rico's going to have to rebuild over the next 5, 10, 15 years at a time when many Americans don't know those are Americans and may not want to spend the money.
It also has another effect in terms of what Puerto Rico can do in terms of making its own choices. So because Puerto Rico is part of the United States, you know, Washington gets to control who gives aid to Puerto Rico. If Puerto Rico were a sovereign country, it could accept outside aid from other countries. So under international disaster relief law and international humanitarian law, which in and of itself is kind of a squishy area of law, but generally speaking, there are, you know, some kind of general principles and they're, you know, sovereignty, right? So you have sovereignty over your own territory, which means that when it comes to providing disaster relief or humanitarian aid, the country who has sovereign control over that territory is the ultimate arbiter of who gets to come in. So an outside country can't just send in troops or even civilians to help a country if it wants to, even if, you know, the territory has been ravaged. So Cuba, even though itself was ravaged by succession of hurricanes, offered to send help to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. The Cuban foreign minister offered to send a team of 39 doctors as well as four brigades of electric workers to help rebuild the electrical grid. But the problem is that the U.S. would have to issue visas to these Cubans to come into Puerto Rico because it's, again, a U.S. territory. And they don't want to do that, right? Because we're mad at Cuba for various reasons. And so, you know, if Puerto Rico were its own country, it could accept this kind of outside aid from all these other countries. But because it's not, it has to just pray and hope that Washington sends enough aid on its own.
I want to go a little back to the point that Joachim made earlier with that number. It is a sad, and if you think about it, kind of infuriating fact about our world that the kind of people that people choose to care about are determined by arbitrary distinctions like borders.
Right.
Where someone was born, who they count as, whether they're perceived as a citizen or not. Why should it matter that whether or not Puerto Rico is a country or whether it's part of the United States in terms of its deservingness to receive disaster relief from Washington? Puerto Ricans are no less human, whether or not they're U.S. citizens or not. And yet, it's striking that when people know that Puerto Rico is part of the United States, all of a sudden they become so much more sympathetic to the plight of these people, as if, you know, their humanity is determined by what's on their passport. That number, it's difficult for me to think about it and to, you know, be as rational and dispassionate, Jen, as you just were in analyzing the plight of Puerto Rico. And when you think about the callousness that that reflects.
I admire that you are such a better human being than I am. Because being somewhat of a cynic, that doesn't surprise me really.
Well, it's not surprising. It's infuriating.
And I don't want to remotely come off as saying that people whose lives are non-American matter less. But it's infuriating, but because it's so not surprising to me, it's like we always think about charity, the cliche about charity being closer to home. We tend to spend it closer to home. But what's interesting also, and gets to a point that you were both hitting, and Jen, very much directly a point you were making, is in a very weird way, you were talking about this in sort of the visa question, but in a very weird way, it is easier to have aid, American aid, large-scale American aid, into a place that is a non-American country. So the Washington Post did a fantastic story about how the U.S. response in Puerto Rico was so much slower and weaker than the U.S. response in Haiti. And this was how the story began. It was talking about how after the Haiti crisis, within days, within weeks to be exact, 2 weeks, there were 33 U.S. military ships, 22,000 American troops, 300 American helicopters, millions of pounds of food and water. Right now, there are about 30 helicopters either there or en route, a few thousand troops, a three-star general just began there overseeing the effort, and just comparing the two. And so, Zach, to your point about we don't always necessarily care, but we can at times do more for people who are non-American than we can for those who are. And it's very, very striking, both in terms of the impact of what's happened till now, but also the impact of what's happening going forward.
So why is that, though? Why is it that a response to Haiti was so much more effective than—
In a weird way, it comes back to sovereignty. You know, Haiti as a sovereign nation can, you know, to the point Jen was making earlier, they can request American aid. American aid under the Posse Comitatus law, the U.S. military can't deploy within sovereign American territory the way it can deploy overseas. So when you have a sovereign country, even one as weak and as impoverished as Haiti, saying, come help us, Cuba can say, come help us if they want to. Puerto Rico, despite being as impoverished, as hard hit, can't in the same way.
It's tricky. I don't want to make it out to sound like it's much better to be out of the United States from Puerto Rico's point of view. In fact, this is hotly debated inside Puerto Rico, and the sense that I get from looking at surveys is that statehood or remaining part of the U.S. is more popular than independence, I think fairly substantially. And that's because you enjoy a lot of benefits. You know, if you're part of the U.S. in some way, you get access to American markets. You get unrestricted travel inside the United States and travel to the U.S. mainland. It's a little bit like talking about Brexit in that sense, right? Like, from Puerto Rico's point of view, being cut off from the U.S. would be substantially worse, even than in a lot of ways, than being subject to this kind of colonial status, which is horrible, right? It's right now the island is in an awful, awful position where it is, well, to put it one way, the pro-status quo party in Puerto Rico will say that its current status is the best of both worlds. They get the benefits of not being part of the U.S. and the benefits of being of not being a state, not being forced to be like all other states, and the benefits of being part of the U.S. as a political territory. Right now, it seems like it's very much the worst of all possible worlds, where they don't get the benefits of being out of the U.S. in terms of additional aid, and they get the consequences of being subject to Washington's misrule.
It's also, it's basically bureaucratic in a lot of ways. It's a bureaucratic problem. So we saw this with the British response to Hurricane Irma. So British territories in the Caribbean were also hit, the British Virgin Islands. And there was this big debate that was happening, this big fight in Britain, where essentially because of budgetary rules, the British Virgin Islands and other territories that were hit hard were not actually eligible for certain aid from the British government, because essentially their economy was too strong. They made too much money because they happened to be fairly economically strong compared to some of the most impoverished countries. So Britain had this pool of aid money that is earmarked for the most impoverished countries in the world for aid. So these British territories that are, you know, part of Britain were devastated. And you would think, well, then take some of that aid money and give it to them and help them. But they couldn't, because technically they didn't count because they weren't bad off enough to register. So essentially, like, that's the kind of the weird problem that you're facing here. And there's a freelance writer named Gregory Scruggs who writes about the Americas and Latin America and the Caribbean a lot. And he wrote a really awesome piece in America's Quarterly in September about how, you know, about this kind of whole dynamic. And this was before Hurricane Maria, but, you know, he was basically using the kind of example of Antigua and Barbuda and the U.S. Virgin Islands to kind of compare and contrast the response there. And so Antigua, Barbuda is a twin island country, but it's a sovereign country. And because of that, it's a member state of the Caribbean Community, CARICOM, which is like an economic kind of regional integration. And it was eligible for international aid and to pull from all these different resources, whereas the U.S. Virgin Islands, as a U.S. territory, were essentially stuck waiting and hoping that Washington would bail them out.
There's a loaded word that hangs over a lot of this. And Zach, you mentioned this word yesterday as we were talking a bit about what we would say today, which is empire. You know, when you talk about Britain and its territories, Britain was the model empire. I mean, not model in terms of doing it well, but model in terms of they had a lot of them all over the world, and they kind of messed up how they ran them. But should we think of the U.S. as an empire with all the fraught and, in some cases, very negative connotations that carries?
Again, it's complicated because there is, as you suggested, a moral component. There's also an analytic component. To what extent does it makes sense to analyze the way that the U.S. administers its global territories and position in the way that Britain did before, or the Roman Empire, or the Mongol Empire, or various different things that are uncontroversially imperial. And I think I sort of come down in a middle squishy ground position here, which is that it makes sense to refer to the United States as maintaining colonial possessions or colonies, places like Puerto Rico or Guam. While at the same time, the rest of the way that the U.S. operates its global position is not especially imperial. So Britain would take control of territory. They would set up British administrations locally. If you were part of the British Empire, that's what you did. But if you're a country like South Korea or Japan, where you're part of what could fairly be described as America's global protectorate network, you're in no way subordinate to the United States, right? You're relying on U.S. guarantees and security guarantees, but you're not politically subject to the U.S. So the mode of governance the U.S. uses globally is not imperial, even though it kind of is when it comes to possessions like Guam and Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I would probably say that we're a little bit better than the Mongol Empire, but like
Jen's hot take of the day.
Marginally.
Well, so the Mongols get a bad rap, right?
Like
the
Zach's Mongols, hot take of the day.
No, ooh, there's a really good book. The author's last name is Weatherford, I believe, about the ways that Genghis Khan and the Mongol Empire invented concepts like religious freedom and diplomatic immunity, which were not all that prevalent in the world at that time, but were useful as ways of administering the Mongol Empire and ended up helping spread those ideas.
Yeah, I think the sacking of Baghdad might disagree with you.
Okay, so murdering people was bad, but religious freedom was good.
Okay, fair. I can agree with you on that.
So, Jen, before you joined us and were slinging hot takes about the not goodness of mass murder / sacking of cities, people may not know that you have an academic background before you became the journalist that you are. So, I mean, how would you answer that question, both as academic think tank person, but also now journalist, Jen, this question of, is the U.S. an empire? Is the U.S. just a colonial power? And what does that all mean?
I would agree with Zach. There are cases where the U.S. has acted as an imperial power. I think empire versus kind of imperialism is a little bit different kind of conceptually, even if they're somewhat synonymous. Yeah, I think, you know, looking at it as a comparison to the British Empire is just, you know, or even, you know, other countries that act as colonial powers, you know, Belgium, France, et cetera, and especially in Africa, I think there's absolutely no comparison whatsoever to the U.S. However, if you look at things like the Iraq War, right, like intervening in another country, overthrowing the government, occupying the country, setting up a new government that we personally handpicked, that definitely smacks of imperialism. So I think I come down the same way as Zach does. It's like a squishy middle ground that I wouldn't call America an empire, but at times we have acted very imperialist.
We're also in this weird moment, even before these catastrophes struck, where there's an academic paper basically recently published making the case for colonialism.
Oh, God.
And
oh,
making,
God.
Making the case for bringing it back. And it exploded in sort of the academic world of people saying, how the hell could this be published? But it was interesting. I was rereading parts of it last night. The best case read you can make for an essay that was not particularly well thought out, not particularly morally or intellectually honest, the best case generous read you can make was maybe if someone in Washington were paying more attention to what is a colony of sorts, maybe this wouldn't be as messed up as it is. But it's an interesting thing to me that we are back discussing whether the U.S. is a colonial power at a time where there are at least some academics who are diving in and saying it is, and it's great. We should have more colonial powers. And then this much bigger pool of academics, you both know that world better, saying, uh-uh, we should not want to bring back colonial powers anywhere on the planet, especially within the U.S.
The general consensus is that the mass murder associated with colonialism dramatically outweighed any potential benefits that one might draw from them. The Belgian
agreed.
Congo was pretty bad.
Yeah, pretty much all of the cases have been pretty bad. Just to kind of wrap it up and bring it back to Puerto Rico, there was a really fascinating op-ed, and I apologize, I can't remember the name of the gentleman who wrote it, but I believe it was in the Washington Post. It was a Puerto Rican man who, for his whole life growing up in Puerto Rico and his adult life, was hardcore pro-independence, so pro-Puerto Rico becoming its own independent sovereign nation. And then Hurricane Maria happened, Hurricane Irma and then Hurricane Maria. And he wrote this op-ed essentially saying, you know, I've been fighting for independence my whole life. I have dreams of us having, you know, our own Olympic Games, right? Just like all of these things that you can have as a sovereign nation. And then he said, but now I'm starting to wonder, you know, after this devastation and looking at how this happened, I think even statehood would be better than this weird in-between quasi-state, quasi-sovereign country, squishy in-between land. And he laid out that if Puerto Rico became a state, it would get 2 U.S. senators, 5 voting members in the House, and 7 electoral college votes. So it would have a voice in Congress. It would have, you know, political power. It would have people who are able to stand up and fight and, you know, represent Puerto Rico's interests in terms of voting against laws that may hurt it. And he's like, you know, I think honestly, that might even be better. You know, I would prefer independence, but that's probably not going to happen. So God, can we at least become a state? And I thought that was a really fascinating way that just this one, you know, or these 2 hurricanes dramatically changed the perspective of people in Puerto Rico as to what is the best for their own interests.
Yeah, Jen, I think that that point that you made about representation in Congress really hammers home the stakes here, right? Puerto Rico is 3.4 million people, as we discussed earlier. That's nearly 6 times the population of Wyoming, right?
Right.
It's 6 times. And not only do they have no representation in Congress, but they're currently suffering in a way that you can barely imagine as a resident of the continental United States. And it took a long time for this to become a national emergency in the way that we were feverishly speculating, frankly, about what might happen to Florida. And Irma turned out to be not nearly so bad as Maria was for Puerto Rico. And it really speaks to the displaced and in some ways disgusting moral priorities that we have through blindness to Puerto Rican residents and their needs.
And there was an amazing quote, and this was from the U.S. Virgin Islands and not Puerto Rico, but it's the similar context as we've been talking about. And there's an incredible quote from a woman named Lauren Saya. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And she was speaking to a reporter, and she said, this is a quote, "The news was just saying that Irma wasn't going to make contact with the U.S. until it hit Florida, when it was going through the Virgin Islands at that time. It just doesn't make any sense. Now that Irma's going to Florida, we're basically just going to disappear." So she was essentially watching the news, and they were saying, oh, it's not going to hit the U.S. till Florida. And she's like, hi, we're the U.S. It's literally on top of us right now. And I think that just reflects how even, you know, the national news is completely acting as if these other places don't even exist and don't matter and aren't part of the United States. And that's just, can you imagine just being a citizen of the United States and sitting there and they're like, oh, good thing it's not going to hit the U.S. for a while. We're fine.
There's also the part of this that while we're talking moral outrage, because I do find this morally sickening. John Oliver, many of you know because we mentioned on the show, is I think the best thing on television right now. A while ago, it was probably close to a year. We'll tweet out the link later in the day. He did a segment on Puerto Rico. Specifically, it was about Puerto Rican debt. And more specifically, about the fact that Puerto Rico cannot declare bankruptcy in quite the same way that U.S. states could. More specifically, the fact that much of the debt Puerto Rico has is owned by New York financial firms. And it's huge amounts of money. And those firms theoretically could basically break what's left of Puerto Rico by saying, pay us back. And there's very, very little the law could do to stop it. Donald Trump this week, without offering any details, said, hey, Wall Street, you're not getting that money, without saying what they would do instead or how we persuade them. But not only, you know, Zach, to your point from before, is there misrule from Washington. And Jen, to your point, not only do we have a situation where Puerto Rico can't govern itself and might be more efficient if it did, we also have a situation very literally where the wealthiest of Americans sitting in one of the wealthiest cities on earth can further impoverish an already impoverished part of made up of fellow Americans.
Yeah, so here's a challenge for President Trump, who campaigned as a populist and has acted basically in no way, shape, or form like the anti-elitist that he claimed he was on the campaign trail. If you really want to stick it to Wall Street, force them to take a haircut on Puerto Rican debt. Do it. Actually do it. Don't just say stuff, right? Like, figure out a way that Puerto Ricans don't have to suffer because creditors on Wall Street want a bunch of money. Let's see how they could do that.
You want to look good in your underwear and be comfortable, but that perfect balance is hard to find. Fortunately, you don't need to sacrifice style. You don't need to sacrifice comfort, because you can check out MeUndies.com and find the best pair of underwear in the world. This is why. It's the most comfortable pair of underwear you will ever own. It's made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric, 3 times softer than cotton. MeUndies is the official underwear, incidentally, of Worldly and many other podcasts here at Vox Media. It comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. They guarantee you will love them or you get your money back. So here's what you do. Here's the offer they have for our listeners. You can get 20% off your first pair and free shipping. And they are so sure you'll love their underwear that they offer a 100% money back guarantee, because if you don't, send them right back, your money comes back too. So it's a no-brainer. 20% off, free shipping, 100% satisfaction guarantee. There is no need to wait. You can go find them. You can go order. Here's what you do. Go to MeUndies.com/worldly. MeUndies.com/worldly. A last time, MeUndies.com/worldly. You can get this great offer. You can get this great underwear. Come find them. Come buy from them. And come enjoy them. Thanks for listening to Worldly. If you're looking for a new podcast to try, how about Planet Money? Give it a listen. Because one thing people say about Planet Money is how much they love listening to it, even though they don't necessarily care about business or economics. It's just a smart show with great stories, it's well produced, and it's fun to listen to. So find Planet Money on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts. Elsewhere this week, we are staying very close in a literal sense to the Vox studio because we're talking something that's happened just a couple of miles away involving friend of show, Yochi favorite, Mr. Charisma, Rex Tillerson.
Woohoo!
Not sure if he's a friend of our show, to be fair.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who may not be Secretary of State Rex Tillerson much longer, although he will always be a friend of the show. That's because he apparently has called President Trump a moron. This is now becoming public. It's for an interesting reason, which we'll talk to in a second. This is not the first time that Tillerson has angered Trump. It's not the first time Trump has maybe thought about, I should fire this charismatic man. One of the first times was this.
And the president's values?
The president speaks for himself, Chris.
So that was Mr. Charisma talking about Trump's response to Charlottesville with his very famous, there are good people on both sides, not just Nazis versus non-Nazis. But we're at a point now where the Secretary of State, in an administration that has had turnover never before seen in recent American history, may not have that job much longer. And I think there's two things we should talk about. One, how the hell did we get here? And two, what happens if Mr. Charisma leaves?
So Rex Tillerson was never especially qualified for this job, right? He ran ExxonMobil, which you thought might be a good qualification. But when I've been reporting a piece this week, actually, on the way that Trump has managed the White House and foreign policy. And one thing that experts on the presidency like to tell you is you can't manage it like a business. And so Tillerson came in and there was this expectation that he would make things more efficient and that his experience talking to world leaders when advancing the interests of ExxonMobil might make him well prepared to run the State Department. But it turns out that he has not only dramatically mismanaged the State Department by trying to like come in and run it like essentially a consultant, but he hasn't been able to figure out how to do diplomacy and get influence inside the White House in the way that a government bureaucrat who actually knows how to work government might do.
I think in some ways, I absolutely agree with you in terms of how he has mismanaged the State Department. You know, he came in wanting to trim the fat and you know, make the bureaucracy smaller and more efficient and tighter. And he's essentially done that by not talking to anyone at the State Department who works for him outside of a small group of his own personal advisors. So essentially shutting out the entire workforce he represents and manages, but also not filling key posts throughout the State Department. The posts, you know, the people who actually go out and do like the lower level diplomacy day to day, who manage all sorts of important and serious issues throughout the world. By that same token, though, I don't know if it's necessarily all his fault that he hasn't been super successful in terms of his own personal diplomacy with other countries. So Tillerson was in China discussing sanctions and pressure on North Korea. And while he was there, he was talking to reporters, and he essentially said, you know, we have direct communications with North Korea. You know, we have, I think he said two or three, you know, direct lines of communication. You know, we're openly talking to North Korea. And then just, I guess, the next day or so, Trump decided to tweet out, quote, I told Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he's wasting his time trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man, meaning Kim Jong-un. And then he said, save your energy, Rex. We'll do what has to be done. So, you know, essentially completely undercutting everything that Tillerson had just said, you know, everything, the message he was sending that, yes, we're, you know, don't worry, we're in direct communications with North Koreans. It's not as bad as it sounds, right? Because one of the biggest issues was that, you know, we might not, you know, there could be a war that could break out accidentally because we just don't have communications.
So, like, this is the dilemma of the Trump administration, right? Is how much do you blame the people that he has put in a situation,
right,
versus the overall circumstances created by a chaotic and poorly run management structure? And, like, that's difficult. And even experts on this aren't really sure. But the sense that I get is that Tillerson gets a significant amount of the blame personally.
Yeah, it's kind of like, do you blame the crappy chicken or the crappy egg? The giant NBC News scoop about Mr. Charisma saying of Trump that he's a moron. What's interesting is about some of the policies where they disagree. So per the article, the specific thing that caused Tillerson's fury was Trump going to the Boy Scouts of America, which Tillerson ran back when people respected Tillerson, and giving this extraordinary politicized speech where he also lied after and said that the Boy Scouts called him to praise him when they didn't. But it's worth pointing out that many of the policies where Trump disagrees with Tillerson, Jen, you may mention one where you undercut him, are actually the same policies. So Tillerson, for instance, has been trying to mediate between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, this crisis we've talked about before, really an important crisis in the Middle East. He's been trying to mediate it. Trump has basically entirely sided with the Saudi Arabians. Tillerson has been saying, let's recertify the Iran deal, which would be a crisis and catastrophe if it was not recertified. Trump didn't want to. Trump has said, let's sanction and possibly send troops into Venezuela. Tillerson has said, don't do it. So he has been a terrible manager, Jen. I agree completely. He has not accomplished much. But policy-wise, he was pushing things that I think many people in our world, journalists, non-journalists, many listeners would think, those are actually pretty good. Problem is, Trump disagrees with all of them.
So, yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right that that article said, you know, that Tillerson essentially was on the verge of quitting after, you know, Trump gave that insanely ridiculous speech at the Boy Scouts of America, especially because Tillerson used to lead the Boy Scouts of America. But the moron line, when he called Trump a moron, actually came a few days earlier after a July 20 meeting at the Pentagon. So Trump went to the Pentagon on July 20th to receive a briefing about Afghanistan and ISIS. And he was there with McMaster, you know, National Security Advisor, Jim Mattis, his defense secretary, and Tillerson. And so they all went to the Pentagon to do this briefing. And apparently it was after this briefing that Tillerson said to many people who were apparently listening that Trump is a moron, which makes me wonder what the hell was going on inside that meeting.
Yeah, I am deeply, deeply curious. But the whole dynamic, right, you mentioned two other people, McMaster and Mattis, and they've both had rough patches in the Trump administration, McMaster more than Mattis, but both of them now seem to be in positions of relative influence, right? McMaster got to fire a bunch of people who were pains in his butt who were aligned with Steve Bannon. Bannon left, who was McMaster's principal enemy inside the White House. And Mattis has done a lot behind Trump's back basically to reassure U.S. allies that, you know, the administration is committed to traditional stuff that it has always done. And what that suggests to me is that those two have done a much better job at gaining influence with this unconventional president.
Zach goes diplomatic.
I mean, you know, I decided to be nice this morning. They are advancing the same set of policies that it sounds like Tillerson also supports. In fact, Chief of Staff John Kelly and Mattis are reportedly Tillerson's two closest allies inside the White House, and they all share these sort of similar sets of takes about the world. But it is one thing to believe in a set of policies that are basically acceptable and another thing to advance them effectively. And it seems that it's that second one in which the Tillerson has dramatically failed.
So actually, I wonder, and this is just completely me speculating here, but I wonder if part of it has to do with Tillerson's background and, you know, business background compared to someone like Mattis and McMaster, right? They're both military people. They're both used to serving under leaders that they essentially have to listen to regardless of what, you know, whether or not they agree with whatever the policy is, whatever the order is, right? Like, that's how the military works. You follow the order and you do your best to carry out the order in a way that is, you know, hopefully not disastrous. You know, and you only ever disobey an order unless it's like completely, you know, unlawful or immoral. But beyond that, you essentially just have to deal with it. Doesn't matter if your commanding officer is a dick, right? Like, you just have to deal with it and do your best to carry out your mission. And it seems like that's kind of what they're doing. But then if you compare that to Tillerson, right? Tillerson has, you know, was the CEO of ExxonMobil. You know, he ran a massive international corporation and probably had his, you know, had a bit of power and freedom to make his own decisions and to not have to answer. I mean, obviously he has to answer his shareholders, but, you know, I think it could be in part that he's not used to working for, you know, and taking orders from someone who maybe he thinks is a moron, for example, where, you know, and I'm just speculating, but that could in part explain why they've had a better experience than Tillerson, and Tillerson has had a harder time kind of getting past that.
Although it's interesting because Tillerson and Mattis are exceptionally close. You know, they talk almost every day per reports. They meet for breakfast at least once a week. They are extraordinarily close and on positions have pretty much lined up on stuff. One thing we've talked about in the past, both privately and on the show, is Rex Tillerson is everything that Donald Trump said he was but isn't. Rex Tillerson is a competent business manager. Rex Tillerson has struck deals all over the world. Rex Tillerson does know how to run big organizations. Donald Trump doesn't.
And Jen, Rex Tillerson is also a personal friend of Vladimir Putin's, which Trump is not.
Well, yeah.
And has said that he was.
Right. He's got to think Trump wants a friendship with Vladimir Putin. But it is interesting that Mattis and Tillerson kind of end up at the same place. But I agree with you completely. If you're Rex Tillerson, there's got to be some part of you that just, even if you didn't think Trump was a moron, you're being lectured to by this guy who you know is not capable of running a business, and you know he's not the billionaire he says he is, and you're being lectured to again and again by this guy. In this article, by the way, I just want to read one paragraph because I loved it. And I also want to give credit to the reporters involved who broke the story. Carol Lee, who's a former colleague of mine at the Wall Street Journal, Kristen Welker, Stephanie Rule, Daphna Linzer. It is a great piece. We'll tweet out the link very shortly.
From NBC.
From NBC News.
Also, hell yeah, all female reporting team.
Whoop!
But it was really a spectacular piece of journalism. But this was a paragraph they had that I absolutely loved. And I'll read it just because it's short and fantastic. Tillerson and Trump clashed over a series of key foreign policy issues over the summer, including Iran and Qatar. Trump chafed at Tillerson's attempts to push him, privately and publicly, toward decisions that were at odds with his policy positions. Hammond, this is Tillerson's spokesperson, said Tillerson has had no policy differences with Trump. The president's policy is his policy, Hammond said. And that is such complete obvious bullshit. There is no doubt, none, that Trump and Tillerson have had policy differences because Trump has tweeted about them. So when you're a spokesman for the Secretary of State and you're trying to say they've always agreed, except the president publicly has said we don't agree, it's a tough thing to sell.
I worry we're being a little too nice to Mr. Charisma in this conversation, because while it is true that a lot of this is Trump's fault, Tillerson has aggressively pushed a plan to slash the State Department's budget and had been repeatedly reprimanded by Congress, who says you can't do that. Congress has drafted bills that would tie his hands to prevent him from implementing this, like, McKinsey-style reorganization of the State Department, as if he, you know, can come in and slash inefficiencies and without knowing anything about how the State Department operates, figure out that you need to fire something like 8% of the staff, right? And that when you alienate your people like this, when you, in contradiction of what every Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense in the past has said, that the U.S. needs a well-funded and more robust State Department than it has to effectively wield influence in the world. When you come in and say, my department is irrelevant, why should Trump listen to you?
And I also think, I mean, there is a way to come in and, you know, try to figure out places where you can cut, you know, inefficiency, where you can cut the bureaucratic fat, right? There are very competent ways to do that, where you sit down with department heads and you sit down with people and, you know, say, hey, you know, where do you think there are inefficiencies? Where do you think there are redundancies here? Or you can go to department heads and say, you know, hey, I want you to come up with an 8% cut in your department. You talk to your team and you decide where you can cut. That's how the Army does it, right? That's how they're doing it right now. Like, they send people and say, let's come up with a plan. But you can't do that by sitting in your office and not talking to literally any of your staff outside of, like, the five people who work in your inner circle. That's not the way to do it. You're not going to get buy-in from the State Department. You're going to have the entire bureaucracy pushing back. And you won't have any actual, like, real justification for what you're doing if you're just doing across-the-board cuts. And that's why Congress is pushing back.
And there's a point you made there that I think is really worth flagging, which is these aren't random jobs that are being left open or eliminated. So just as Trump was announcing his new strategy for Afghanistan, which is basically do the old strategy for Afghanistan, Tillerson eliminated the position within the State Department, the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. The State Department officials who do policy towards Asia, especially towards Korea, are not filled. Those jobs are still open. So it's not just in the abstract sense, as you're both referencing, it is also, as you're also referencing, that there are specific jobs that really matter that are not full. And remember, there was an earlier story about Mr. Charisma that people on the 8th floor of the State Department, where his office is held, were told not to make eye contact with him as he walked by, not to speak to him directly. And we can, I think, all say that if you're trying to manage anything other than perhaps Genghis Khan back in the day, telling people don't make eye contact with the boss, not necessarily leadership.
You're not fucking Khal Drogo over here.
This is why I could never work in the government, because if I ever received that order, I would purposely follow him down the hall, just staring him right in the face and just walking like a creeper for like 10 yards. Just because, like, fuck you. Don't look you in the eye. What are you, like, a prince? Come on.
Yeah, I think this is like how we all ended up in an office where we can wear t-shirts and flip-flops.
Okay, fair. That's fair.
But, like, look, why on earth would you prioritize cutting the State Department budget right now? It's less than a tenth of the Pentagon's. And currently we are dealing with massive crises with Russia, North Korea, a series of different ones in the Middle East.
Famine in Africa.
Yeah, Venezuela is in shambles. There's something going on with Cuba and sonic attacks on U.S. diplomats. It's not even clear what's happening there, right? There are a series of, like, high-level controversies and a world that's fundamentally deeply unsettled by the president, right? Who Tillerson knows, as is clear from this reporting that came out today, as is clear from the NBC News piece, Tillerson knows that Trump has destabilized the world, right? Like, he knows that people might have good reason not to trust this man. And yet he's spending a bunch of time trying to cut the fat from a budget that's already lower than it should be? Like, why? Why would you do this?
There's a vital point that's buried in that I just want to suss out for a second. Jim Baker, who had been the Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, for many academics and many people who study foreign policy, is held up as one of the best of the post-World War II part of the 20th century, because everyone in the world knew that when he spoke for President Bush. There was never a question about that. And people who study this say that that's the single most important part of being Secretary of State. World leaders have to know if Secretary of State Yolki Drizin is speaking for President Zach Beecham, we're speaking—
Or President Jen Williams. I could be president too, I'm just saying.
Come on, Jen. This is America, 2017. We don't talk about female leaders. Come on.
You're a lady.
She persists. But you can have President Jen Williams and Secretary of State Julie Bogan, who's one of the great people working on Worldly. You can have those people speaking in one voice, and that really, really matters. Here, not only do they not speak in the same voice, they speak in the exact opposite voices, which is kind of remarkable. I do want to circle back to one thing before we close, which is when the Rexit happens, and all of us are waiting to use that headline, the Rexit is coming, who comes next? And the rumors for some time have been it'll be the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, who's done a very good job both articulating a sane foreign policy, not stumbling as much as Mr. Charisma has. But maybe let's close there. If it is Secretary of State Nikki Haley and not Secretary of State Donald Trump, Zach, to your point, does that make anything better? Or is Trump just so bad a manager, so mercurial, so incapable of trusting his subordinates that really it won't?
I mean, I think it depends, right? On some issues, Haley's policy preferences are much wilder than Tillerson's are. Like, she can give a speech, but if you go and read the speech that she gave recently on the Iran deal, it's full of errors and ends up coming to a conclusion about the deal, a sort of partial scrapping of it that doesn't make any sense, right? Her criticisms of it are just not well-founded and barely logically coherent, right? Maybe she would be a better manager. I hope so, if she ends up getting the job, but it's not clear to me that she would have a benign influence on U.S. foreign policy.
To be fair, I think part of the reason why her speeches come across, or at least specifically that one, as, you know, ideologically or structurally incoherent is because, according to earlier reporting, she has to run everything she says by the president, by the White House, that she's, after she spoke sort of off the cuff and said something that the president didn't agree with, he essentially said, you know, you have to run everything by me. I'm not sure Rex Tillerson has that same requirement.
Like, clearly he doesn't.
Clearly. Well, right. And just, you know, just remember a week or two ago, he was, you know, they were, I believe, on the sidelines of the UN, and he was meeting with, like, Iranian kind of diplomats, and they were talking about, you know, the Iran deal. And he came out of this you know, private conversation and told reporters, no, the president hasn't decided on the Iran deal. And like an hour later, Trump came out and told reporters that he was sitting, you know, in the Oval Office and said, oh, I've decided. Absolutely. You'll hear soon. And it was super embarrassing, again, to Tillerson, who, you know, looks like either A, he's completely lying and therefore is not credible in his conversations with the Iranians, or B, is not credible in his conversation with the Iranians because he doesn't even know what his own president thinks. So, I mean, I think at least Haley would probably know where the president stands if, you know, that requirement was kept on her, in the sense that she would, you know, have to find out, okay, what do I have to say? What would you like me to say at this speech? Whereas Tillerson doesn't seem to be doing that.
I think there's also no question that the optics of a Secretary of State Haley would be a lot better than Secretary of State Tillerson. She does not come from an extractive industry. She does not come with a friendship to Vladimir Putin. She's not an aging white male who's sort of the, if you were casting someone to look like a former oil CEO, you couldn't cast better than Rex Tillerson. And optics matter, right? Like, the image of the United States matters. We know Donald Trump considered Mitt Romney a Secretary of State because he said of Mitt Romney, he's from central casting. So it matters to Donald Trump, who sees the world as a TV show that he is inexplicably the star of. But the optics do matter. And I think one question we'll see the answer to whenever the Rexit happens is, does a better face of the United States make a difference? Or does the face not matter when the policies underlying it don't change? I think that's going to be in some ways the big question for whenever the Rexit takes place and we have Secretary of State blank.
Yeah, there's one quote that I got when I was speaking. There's one something that a scholar of American foreign policy named Paul Musgrave at the University of Massachusetts told me recently that really stuck in my mind when we talk about this sort of stuff. He told me that given the way that Trump runs his administration, the choices for a Secretary of State are only choosing between varieties of failure. And I think that's a really good way to think about it, right? Because Tillerson failed by butting up against Trump and also unnecessarily fighting his own department. Haley, to me, seems like someone who's set up to fail in the precise opposite way, because she'll be forced to adhere to Trump's line, but the line that Trump sets is often bizarre, self-contradictory, and incoherent. You have choice over some things. Tillerson's biggest discretionary failure is fighting with the department and pushing for State Department cuts. But if you try not to rock the boat, you end up creating a different set of problems. It just, varieties of failure strikes me as the album title I would use for the Trump administration.
I think otherwise, that is a great way to end. It is a great name for an album, great name for a future history of the Trump administration.
The band is called Sexy Rexy.
I'll let that one just linger. So before I close, for next week, we're going to try something new, which are questions from all of you. We'll do a speed round of questions from people who listen, who like the show. Hit us up on Twitter using hashtag worldly. Before we close, I want to always thank our producer, Jillian Weinberger, our excellent and very well-dressed engineer, Peter Leonard, Julie Bogan. Find us on Apple Podcasts, find us on Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google, any place where you can subscribe to a podcast, rate, review, hopefully rate and review positively. We look forward to being with you all next week. You can find us again, always email worldly@vox.com, hashtag worldly on Twitter. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Yochi.
Thanks. And bye.
But before we go bye, we have a bonus, a small bonus, which is friend of show, Vox superstar Alex Ward is getting married this coming Saturday in Vermont. Huge congratulations to Alex, to his fiancée and soon-to-be wife, Christine. Alex has been on the show, is a fantastic reporter for us, covering defense and national security. I rarely want to speak for colleagues, but I will in this particular case and say, congratulations, Alex. We hope you have a very, very long lifetime of happiness. See you all next week.